Welcome to another episode of Beta Talk. I'm with one of my usual guest hosts, Ken Bone, and we've travelled down to Cornwall to meet a very interesting chap called Richard Lowes. I know him as Policy Rich. We've been interacting quite a bit now on Twitter. And as you'll hear, Richard is involved in the world of policy. So this episode is going to discuss policy, obviously energy, renewable energy, and policy comes into it in a big way. I'd like to thank my sponsors, which is MCS, and you can find them on mcscertified.com. So Richard, I'm going to come to you. So if you could explain to the guests what you actually do.
Okay, well, hi Nathan, and thanks so much to both of you for travelling down. It's a hell of a journey. So I've been working on all of the policy and regulation to do with heating for over 10 years now, and all of that is focused around sustainability. So primarily, how do we get more renewables into the UK's energy system, and how do we meet our climate change targets, which more recently we're now talking about net zero by 2050. And we know that energy systems don't just change. You have to have regulation and policy to drive those changes. And so all of my research really looks at questions around policy and regulation. And I try and do research that's interesting, that's quite fun, but also that can actually help policymakers make decisions around sustainable heating.
So who are the policymakers? How does that sort of structure work?
Okay, well, I think often people think that the policymakers are the politicians and the civil servants. And those, you know, civil servants are basically the bureaucrats in government who draft regulations and design policies. And it's then the politicians, so the ministers, who are the politicians who run government departments, and members of parliament, so MPs, they actually have the power to vote on legislation and to decide what legislation gets through, as it were. So you have the civil servants designing policy often in association with the politicians, but it's always the politicians that have the final say. So they're the sort of key, I guess, powerful parts of the policy change process. But there's a much wider policy network going on. So policy change doesn't just happen in this one space in Westminster. It's happening, you know, at this table. We're all talking about policy, and people can interact with policymakers. Ideas can come from outside of government. So actually, what a policymaker is not that easy to define, because we can all have an impact, as industry does. So I'd say policymakers in general are people who are involved with policy, and also who have some sort of impact on it.
So, and how did you get involved? Did you went and did your degree, your master's, you've done your PhD, I think.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So tell us a bit about your journey of how you got involved with policy.
So I, since being a kid, really was interested in environmental issues. I studied geography and sciences, and did them at A level, and then decided I wanted to do some sort of degree in something environmental. So I moved down to Cornwall, where I started my degree, which was around geography and environmental management. And through that, with very experienced mentors, Professor Catherine Mitchell and Bridget Woodman, who I still are friends and I still work with, went down an energy-focused pathway. My master's course was energy policy and sustainability, and that was obviously a strong focus on policy, all with the goals of renewable energy in mind. And then following that, I went into a corporate role. So I worked for SGN, which was previously Scotia Gas Networks, working on policy and regulation around the future of the gas grid. And then I've moved back to Cornwall about 6 years ago, where I've started working, or my focus is now just on really how can policies promote change in the good direction.
I imagine that's quite interesting. Interesting work for you at the moment, isn't it?
I really enjoy it, and I think I'm lucky to be in the job that I do, because I get to really focus on something that I'm really passionate about, and I make sure that I do work hard, because I think I feel like I'm in a lucky position. I find it quite frustrating. The things that we know need to happen, obviously, just aren't happening, and the existing policies that are out there to try and support the UK's journey towards sustainable heating clearly aren't adequate. And we know they've not been adequate for years. And the policy change just hasn't caught up with the requirement of what actually needs to happen. or even learn from what's currently going on. So I'm optimistic, I think, about the technologies that we can use to help us get to clean heating, but I'm frustrated that the policy making is well behind where we need to be, really.
And we're going to talk about some technologies in a minute with Ken, because you've had a heat pump system installed. It's worth me mentioning to my listeners, one of the reasons I started on this journey of podcasting is, obviously coming from an engineering background within the heating industry, we're a voice. Heating engineers are a voice that I think is a very quiet voice in this sort of a very big conversation around energy. And so one of the reasons I started this podcast was so I could disseminate or amplify the voice of engineers, because they are the ones working with this technology day in, day out. And I sometimes feel and get frustrated that a lot of people involved in this big, big conversation around energy don't listen to the engineers who actually know the technology that's being talked about. And it's worth mentioning, so Richard and I, we started communicating on Twitter about 2 years ago, and Richard kind of epitomises what I wanted to do. So Richard's in the world of policy, and he's engaging all the time with people like myself on Twitter, people like Gasman God, even back, you know, and people like Ken. And it's really, really great. It's really refreshing. It's really lovely, actually, and wonderful that and Richard has a very good community that's obviously in sort of his cohort, and it's great because they are engaging with us. We're coalface engineers, aren't we, Ken? And
we are.
We're on the ground. You're doing this day in, day out. You're seeing technology day in, day out.
Yes, absolutely.
And as much as people are passionate when they're involved in these discourses around, you know, I speak around the country and I speak with some wonderful people. They've got some wonderful statistics going on behind them in the background on their PowerPoints. But unfortunately, I can tell they actually don't really know what they're talking about. So when they're talking about heat pumps, and that's not being elitist, but when they're talking about technologies and heat pumps and et cetera, maybe, it's they don't really know the fundamental things they're talking about. And this is why this podcast is important. It's helping engineers get their voices heard. And Rich has been very, very good at helping disseminate that message. So, Ken, you've came here today. We've had a little look at Richard's system. It's a new system. Just describe what he's got.
Richard's got a heat pump system combined with a radiator upstairs circuit and a low temperature underfloor heating in screed or poured screed circuit. And it's been designed to run as low as possible in flow temperatures, which would then give the heat pump a really good COP. So it's trying, the heat pump's actually running as efficiently as it possibly can. Richard's just told me that the actual thermostats he's got in the property that will turn off zones and circuits are not actually getting hit in set point, because he's finding the comfort temperature is quite happy just running it on a curve. And a curve is, you can have a weather compensation curve, and I know I've talked about this in the past, but a weather compensation curve, you can have that with a gas boiler, an oil boiler, or a heat pump system. And what it does is it actually tries to, it talks and monitors the outside temperature, and it uses the outside temperature as a reference point. And that reference point then, through modulation, whether it be gas boiler modulation or heat pump modulation, will say, I only need you to run me a 30 degree flow because it's only 5 degrees or 10 degrees outside. So you're not running a boiler or heat pump 100% when it's 10 degrees outside or when it's minus 2 outside. It's not running 100%. It will modulate using that point of reference of the ambient temperature. And because of that, things like weather compensation and those points of reference for the heating technology that it's working with becomes much, much more efficient. And we were talking about the other day about gas boilers, and on Twitter recently we've been talking about getting your return temperature of a gas boiler down so your gas boiler is actually condensing. So that is definitely a technology that would help that happen far more than maybe a gas boiler being left on a fixed flow temperature.
It's worth mentioning, obviously this is a renewable series, but when we hear people speak and that their focus is on new technologies and policy, we've got a lot of gas boilers in this country, and a lot of them are not working efficiently. So they were sold to be high efficiency boilers, which they are.
Yes.
But the systems they've been put onto haven't been tweaked so that they actually do run efficiently. And like you said, you know, you've done some rough calculations. If we actually focus on that as well, let's, you know, get these gas boilers working efficiently. That saves an astronomical amount of carbon. You know, getting these return temperatures down low on our boilers across the country would actually help us meet these carbon targets. So obviously we've got to focus on the future and the renewable technologies going in, but we've got technology already there that we were told in the year 2005 was highly efficient. It's not, because your return temperature, unless it's getting lower than 54, you're not really hitting any efficient. You've got to be quite a lot lower than 54 as well. Everyone thinks, oh, I've hit dew point, 54 return temperature, bang, lovely. No. And so this, I think you did a rough calculation, didn't you? We could save...
It basically, if 13 million gas users went to weather compensation, you'd save enough gas to heat another 4 million homes.
And we don't get hear this talked about now in our industry, do we, Ken? We're hearing, obviously, people like that. Hot Water and Heating Industry Council, they're talking about hydrogen boilers. Some of the manufacturers are talking about hydrogen boilers. I'd like to hear them talking about getting their methane boilers working properly and efficiently.
Yes, absolutely. We talk about it a lot in social medias. There's still a lot of, and it's not necessarily the engineer's fault, and it's not necessarily the manufacturer's fault. It can be a combination of all the ingredients, but there are a lot of boilers that are being swapped out on boilers that may not need swapping out. Some heating companies, engineers are almost putting a finger in the air on guessing what new boiler they want to put in. Generally overside, we've talked about this with Rob Berridge and heat calculation, and you know, getting a basic new heat calculation done, even for a gas boiler swap. I tell you, if you did one, you'll be pleasantly surprised and think, really, is that calculation actually correct? Because that is telling me I need to fit a boiler maybe half the size of the one that's in there currently.
So coming back to Richard. So Richard, you've had this new system installed, and I remember engaging with you on social media when you were first thinking about this. And because obviously in the country, lots of people are talking about we've got to put in lots of heat pumps. And some of us engineers said, yeah, that's good, but it's not going to be, we know for a fact, it's not an easy sort of transition, because we've got a situation, what's happening in this country, where loads have gone in and they're not being going in properly. There's companies that have set up. I mean, Ken and I were talking about a company that we heard of, you know, they want to be putting in 100 units a week. And that rings alarm bells for us, because we think, oh, they're not going to be designed properly, set up properly. What was the process for you like having your system installed?
I think the process for me was not a normal process. So I think generally as a customer, if you want a heat pump, you'll go onto Google and you'll find a local heat pump installer, or you might go onto the MCS website, because that's where I tend to put people towards. And you'll find an installer or a company who is accredited. And with that accreditation, you'd hope would have the right skills. I, as a non-normal consumer, and I guess sort of with a bit more information than your average punter, decided that I wanted to go with a particular company. So I knew I wanted a Nebe, because I knew they were quiet, I knew they were quite efficient, and they weren't ugly white boxes. They're ugly grey boxes instead. So I decided that I wanted a Nebe. That then meant that the market was limited. So I looked at who could install Nebes in Cornwall, and there weren't many people on the Nebe website. And I was advised to go to Newheat, who are based actually not that far away from Cornwall. They're based in Exeter. And Newheat run this umbrella scheme where they will specify the equipment and they will design the system, and then you can get a plumber without any sort of heat pump, or the plumber doesn't need to have the MCS accreditation themselves. They act as a subcontractor to Newheat, and Newheat takes responsibility for all of the MCS. So I found my supplier and then the builder who was doing the extension on the house, and it's worth saying I think this is quite a big house project. It was a house that hadn't been touched for about 50 years that's been transformed into a very energy efficient small terraced house still. The builder recommended his plumber, And spoke to the plumber. Plumber said, no problem whatsoever. I've fitted air source, ground source heat pumps before. I've even done new heat before. So no problem with that. Then I decided that it would be a good idea to try and make it as complicated as possible. So I wanted to have some sort of independent control of the upstairs and downstairs heat circuits. So I wanted to be able to turn upstairs on and downstairs off, and vice versa, and have them on and off at different times. Because, and I think we'll come on to this.
Don't forget about the tariff.
Yeah, exactly. So the reason I wanted to do that was because there's now a smart time of use tariff from a company called Octopus Energy. Octopus is sort of like the Google of the energy supply business, basically. And the prices change every half an hour. And based on those prices, you can actually get... Last night, I was being paid to use energy at 3:30 in the morning. So sometimes the prices go negative. But as a rule, the prices are around a third the price of electricity or less, maybe half of normal electricity. But those prices peak between the hours of 4 and 7 in the afternoon. So in between 4 and 7, prices maybe go up to 25 or even 30p for a unit of electricity, so much higher. So in theory, you can, with the heat pumps, you can move your heating demand outside of those off-peak, outside of those peak times. And then in theory, you can get a heat via the heat pump, which is the same cost as gas. So in order to do that, I was recommended to add a component to the heat pump system, which basically gives me a what's called a second climate zone. So independent control of two different areas. So I could charge up the underfloor heating, and then I'd have upstairs able just to come on at these expensive peak times if needed, just in case the house got a bit cold. I was pretty confident, I still am pretty confident, there's so much concrete slab in here, or so much screed on top of the pipes, that the house will stay warm, and it's been fine. So I went to have this separate thing added to the heat pump, and somehow I ended up having to manage the plumber, the electrician, and also engage with the heat pump supplier and the heat pump manufacturer, because no one wants to talk to each other. The issue is that there was no one leading it, and it ended up being me in charge of sort of managing and bringing the whole thing together, which is, as someone who's never had any plumbing experience really, and doesn't know, has no technical training in this, that was quite challenging. I'm pretty happy now that I know what all of the different components are, and it's fun.
You'd be perfect for one of these retrofit coordinators, aren't you?
Yeah. So I know what blending valves do, blah blah blah, and I can point out all of the different elements of my heating system, which is nice for me. But that would have been very, very complicated for a normal customer. The other issue I had, so as well as having to manage all these different parties, the other issue, and I should say some of the parties didn't do what they said they'd do, and a big part of that was the plumber, who actually didn't finish the job. He just didn't turn up one day and never turned up again, and we don't know why, but there was some sort of personal reason given, but that does mean that this model where the whole process is supposed to be led by a heating engineer without the MCS does sort of fall down in those examples, because there's no one for me to go to. So I eventually had to piece some of it together myself, had a very, very experienced electrician who could read all the heat pump diagrams, and eventually had to get a second heat pump specialist firm out to come and fill up the system, commission it, and fix all of the leaks. And there were numerous leaks. Not on the actual radiator underfloor circuits, but in the actual heating cupboard itself, and at the back of the heat pump, where he had just got brass on brass without any sort of sealant in some cases. So he clearly wanted to get out of the house as quickly as possible.
Not the best experience by the sounds of things. But you could get that. You could get that with a boiler or heating installation as well.
Yeah, I mean, because we come from engineering background, yeah. So I mean, it's as we know, Ken, it's a very hard job. And like I say, sometimes these engineers get involved with these larger companies, and sometimes they're not getting the support or backup, and then sometimes they realise they're involved in the job where... So I mean, I always like to stick up for engineers, don't I? But so you've clearly had quite a heterogeneous process. No one's sort of really communicating with each other. And it's worth mentioning there's this whole thing about retrofit coordinators coming in, which is supposed to kind of mitigate that. The problem is, I know for a fact your average retrofit coordinator won't have a Scooby-Doo about heating systems. Not a clue. And I don't care how many days' courses they go on, they still won't have a clue.
No.
So that's something that HHI, C&I maybe agree on. But don't get me wrong, I think there's parts of that scheme that do make sense. There is parts of that scheme that do make sense where basically the whole point of that scheme, I think, is to make sure it's managed very well for the customer.
And I should say, so if I'd gone with, so the company in Cornwall that I used was ZLC, and they fit heat pumps and they fit solar, they're sort of two big bits. If I'd gone with them, it would have been easy. I wouldn't have had to think about anything, and they wouldn't have expected me to even look at any drawings or diagrams. And normally, I think if an engineer is going with the new heat model, it works fine. But the situation I got into was too many cooks spoiling the broth. I'd wanted something specific.
And you were coordinating it with your builder and everything
else.
And those sort of projects can break down just from coordinating all the trades together.
Hmm.
I do like the umbrella schemes, and I think moving forward for trying to get these technologies into people's homes, we are going to need more of those. What concerns me and what I'm experiencing with some certain aspects of trying to fit renewables into properties is back in the PV boom, a lot of companies were able to almost put it into a box, and that box generally fitted most properties in the UK. And some companies are trying to do exactly the same with retrofitting of a heat pump system to a property. Now, in my experience, that can work, sometimes works, but majority of the time, you cannot box package a system and go to somebody's house with not knowing the heat loss calculations, the design, what they're going to come up with, what the electricity supply is, what the common pipe work circuit sizes are, without having that information given to the contracting team, the contracting engineers. So you might actually turn up to a job thinking it's going to be X, Y, and Z, when in actual fact it's A, B, and C. And so straight away you want a downside. And a lot of these contractors, they're on a specified price. They might be on a specified time limit to get these jobs knocked out. And we talked, Nathan, about, a couple of guys that I overheard talking about doing 120 units a week. There are companies already out there trying to knock these systems out as quick as possible in the shortest of time, not paying quite enough detail attention to the detail and the calculations. And that's going to come back and bite us.
Well, it's going to give renewables a bad name.
And it gives renewables a bad name.
One of the saddest things for me about that, and I'm quite connected to a lot of manufacturers. One of the saddest things about that for me is manufacturers are letting that happen. And if you are a manufacturer, because basically, and it's their business model, it's understandable. Their business model fundamentally is to sell units. That's what they're in existence for, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's their business model. But if you are, you've got to really watch this closely, because if you are having companies that are actually purchasing that amount of units off you, your alarm bell should be ringing, or you need something in, because
I mean, companies that are putting in
50 units a week, and you can look at their structure and say, well, how many engineers, who are they actually subbing this work to, and you really need to keep on top of that, because A, it could bite you, and it's obviously going to give renewables a bad name as well. So it's in your best interest, I think, isn't it?
And we're not saying that every company is bad, because there are some really great engineers out there that are trying to come to the forefront of these technologies. There's some really good companies out there, and I know quite a few, and I actually work for quite a few good companies that are not ripping people off. They do proper calculations. They then engage me to go and install that system for them. And that's actually sort of 60-70% of my work. But there are always bad pennies out there in the system. So,
and they're not hard to spot, are they? No. I mean, manufacturers should be able to spot them easily. If they're putting that amount of units in that quickly, you know, putting a unit in every 2 days, the alarm bells have got to be ringing because there's a big process involved in this.
Go
on, Richard.
I was just going to say, I'd echo what you've just said about the appliance manufacturers who were selling heat pumps. They need to be so careful because we know that we need a lot of heat pumps if we're going to meet any of our green energy targets. Loads, multiple millions of these, replacing, in some cases, gas boilers. And the worst thing that could happen, and it's a shame because the technology has come on a lot in the past 10 years, so efficiencies are up, costs have come down, the interface is much better, much more friendly. So there's a really good news story that can be sold. But if, you know, if there is another boom and it turns out to be that these are put in badly and people are getting terrible bill spikes, houses aren't getting warm enough, that's going to give them such a bad name, and it is just the start of the journey. And that could be a real issue for our sort of long-term ambitions.
How do you think manufacturers could mitigate? I mean, I don't know. One of my family members was involved in corporate sales for a long, long time. And in essence, it's about numbers and figures. And I think that's what goes on in the manufacturers. The bigger the manufacturers are, they have massive departments that is all about corporate sales. They don't really think outside the box about actually what's going on. Mm. It's all about the numbers. And then that filters down within the pyramid. You know, the salespeople out there on the road, they need their numbers. I think they've got to be. They've got to change their model a little bit because, like you say, it's gonna affect this a lot.
I don't want to be too cynical. Some manufacturers, in not so many words, they don't care too much for the little installer. They will try and sell you their product, and that's fine. What they like is the big companies, the big corporates that buy thousands of units a year. Now, that company that is buying thousands of units a year has a lot of weight. So I dare say it, but some manufacturers might turn a blind eye to that company's installation quality, how they do things, perhaps the companies, the contractors that they employ, because they know that company will go to a competitor. And it is a numbers game.
So it comes down to economics again, doesn't it?
But my heat pump is linked to the internet, so NEBI can read the data off it. It's going to have full electricity metering as well soon. So we will be able to... We can do two things. So we can work out exactly what the performance of the heat pump is. So we can work out what the seasonal coefficient of performance is. That is, in total for the house, how many units of electricity have gone in and how many units of heat have come out. The other thing that you can see with the software, so it speaks to the internet and it's recording data every few minutes, you can see exactly how the heat pump is performing. So you'll know whether it's at its maximum capacity too much, you'll know if it's not working. I mean, it is the internet age, isn't it? And it's not that difficult to monitor things.
So no, I think, like you said, NEBI do it, and I think some other people. And I'm in talk to someone because I want to do it independently. So I want to have an independent site that can monitor people's systems. Because once again, the manufacturer might see that something's awry, and obviously the customer has got access to that data, but they probably wouldn't know that something's awry.
No.
Whereas an independent database or whatever you call it, and I've got people... I'm talking with at the moment. So I think manufacturers might want to do that. Mm. But once again, if they're selling units, and they don't want to lose these people to a competitor, do they, Ken? You know, these big buyers.
Heat pumps are a complicated technology. We talked about this on the way down. You've only got to have a very little bump in the road of the installation design, pipe work process, and it can be a real upset for a heat pump. A gas boiler tends to get away with, you know, improper installation of pipe work or design or radiators. You can fudge it a lot more with a gas boiler. Heat pumps don't do that. But the problem is customers like simple controls. So if you are asking them, some of us that are technical, yes, we like looking at data, and you could put a load of data of a week's working of a heat pump in front of me, and I could see what was going on, when it was performing good, when it had done a hot water cycle, all those sort of things. Oh, why is it doing that certain cycle at that point in time? We can analyse it. A customer wouldn't know. Mm. Yes, they've got the app on their phone. They can see the unit's running. It's delivering hot water. They're warming the house. That's all they care about. That's fair enough. So again, I think the manufacturers, even though they are possibly monitoring, I don't think they'd be so quick in pointing fingers too quickly at bad installations.
Well, that's why I want the independent one, because also the independent monitoring, there's engineers out there that know they can do good stuff, and they want to be able to do that good stuff and be valued by consumers. So they won't mind having their systems monitored, because a consumer that's thinking about a heat pump system can then go to that one single site and think, all right, this engineer's doing some really good stuff. It's got, you know, it'll have some sort of tally system that shows that they're really, you know, their systems are really good. And that just gives consumers confidence. It also helps engineers, because it means engineers actually start to get paid what they're worth, I think. I think our customer base in England needs to, or the UK, needs to realise a good engineer is worth their weight in gold. They really, really are. So I think it's a very nice system that can perpetually sort of help engineers that want to do good stuff get valued, help a consumer find someone that's good, because that's very tough for them. So I think it's good. I think it's going to be a good win-win situation. I'm going to come back to Richard's. You're to do a PhD, for anyone that doesn't know, you had to do some sort of thesis. Just describe us a little bit, because that was quite interesting for you. You got you engaging with the heating community, didn't it?
Yeah, so I started my PhD in 2014, and alongside it, I've worked on various projects. So I've been doing a few different things at once. My PhD was really looking at the development of policy for heating, for sustainable heating in the UK, how it had started, and I was particularly interested in how different interests were putting their views forwards, and how they were lobbying, so how they were trying to influence the government to do things that suited their own interests. And so to do that, I did a lot of interviews. So I travelled up and down the country, spoke to various different companies, organisations, policymakers and politicians, just to really develop this really complicated but really thorough story of how heat policy had developed in the UK and why it had turned out, the way it did. And, you know, my thesis is online, and there's one chapter that just talks about the different elements of policy change and what's actually happened. There's a section on condensing boilers and how those regulations came in. There's sections on how the RHI developed and why it developed in particular ways. And then there's also sections on the larger heat strategy and why we're looking at, you know, whether we should put hydrogen into the gas grid or use lots of heat pumps. Alongside that work, and I guess probably more of interest for this, was I did a project where we were looking at the gas industry and what they were up to. Around sustainable heating. It was called Heat Incumbency and Transformations. And incumbency just means the people who are already in the market. And for that project, I spoke to a lot of the gas interests in the UK's heat sector. And I was just trying to work out really what they were up to, because there's this big question in academic studies about whether existing industries can help drive change or whether they can help hinder it. That's the big fundamental question. And we know from other things like transport and even fossil fuel production, that often big industrial sectors have tried to stop change, basically. Tobacco is another one. So the tobacco industry has actively fought against regulation and tried to market itself as not as bad as it was supposed to be. So the question we really had is, you know, what is the gas industry up to, and is it going to help the UK's transformation to sustainable heating? And you know, what we found really was that it was all about self-protection. So people wanted to maintain gas boiler sales and they wanted to maintain the gas grid. And it was those two different parts of the industry, the appliance manufacturers and the gas grid operators, they were the ones that just wanted to keep the status quo. And their idea basically is that you can just decarbonise the gas grid. So that is, you can replace fossil gas with some sort of clean green alternative. And as part of that drive, you know, they've been saying heat pumps don't work, think of the consumer, which often just means don't do anything to change anything.
And there's a lot of marketing, isn't there?
Absolutely,
marketing,
yeah.
Spin.
And
yeah.
The gas industry is billions and billions of billions of pounds a
That's
year.
That's it. And the huge issue is that the heat. So heat pumps are massive globally, and you know, fridges are the same technology as heat pumps, set up slightly differently. And you know, in countries like Sweden and Scandinavia, heat pumps dominate heating. There's huge amounts of them. So globally, we know that they work. But in the UK context, where 85% of people are connected to the gas grid, there's just this huge gas market. And we're actually, as a country, not unique, but there aren't many countries that have as big a gas network as we do. And the natural thing is, there's just a massive industry behind it. And there's not a massive heat pump industry in the UK. And so the gas industry's got the capacity to put up loads of money to pay for lobbying groups, to pay for parliamentary events, blah, 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 all of this stuff, to pay for consumer marketing
as
well. Keep
the barriers up.
Keep the barriers up, and try and put down the new technologies as well. Mm. It wasn't a particularly happy piece of research. And I think...
Did you come across... Once you went out to meet these people, did you sort of come across some sort of... were you starting to find that there were certain people involved in this industry that didn't like you and your research? should I put it like that?
Well, I think because a lot of these people work on policy and communications, everyone always likes to keep it polite. So, as a whole, most people are polite. I still engage with loads of different people in the appliance manufacturing world, and I still do some work for a gas network company as well. So, I think the relationship's still good. There are certain individuals who are just unpleasant and just have their own interests at heart, and that's fine. You'll always get them. But it wasn't. You know, the piece of research wasn't to attack anyone. It was really just to look at what's going on. And I think people just didn't like having a light shone on what was going on.
Do you think? And in the last few years, do you actually think things are changing? Is there any particular point that you can reference to a major change coming?
So I'd say I'm optimistic, and I said this already, I'm optimistic about technologies. I think, you know, the one thing that the heating sector and the gas is the same, and they're separate. What everyone is often not very good at is looking at the bigger picture. And so the thing that I think maybe of gas engineers and probably the general public don't realise is that the cost of renewable energy has got a lot cheaper over the past few years. Specifically, solar and wind power are much cheaper and are comparable to standard fossil fuel generation. And the amazing thing that's happened, and it's a silent revolution, a silent and invisible revolution, is that the North Sea is being filled up with offshore wind turbines that are competing on a price basis with gas power stations. Now, that's something that was never really expected to happen. People thought there would be cost reductions, but people didn't think they'd happen that quickly, and they didn't think they'd be at the scale that they are.
It's like becoming cheaper than megawatt hour per, firing up a gas power station and stuff like that.
You know, if we've got renewable electricity that's the same price as gas-powered electricity, actually, the case for electrifying everything, so a mass conversion to electric vehicles and a mass conversion to some form of electric heating, suddenly looks a lot cheaper. Or certainly cheaper than it was originally expected to be. So I'm optimistic from a technology perspective. I'm pessimistic from a policy change perspective, because while the technologies have got cheaper, which is great, they don't just deploy themselves, and people don't just switch to something because it's cheaper or better for the environment. And that's where the policy's got to come in. So it's got to enable people to make these changes. And that's just not there. So we know that the renewable heat incentive, which is, you know, the policy measure that I've spent a lot of time researching the performance of, is, you know, underperforming massively. It's been a total failure. We need to be clear, it's been a total failure, a very expensive failure. So £23 billion in total. You could buy a nuclear power station for that. And what we've ended up
is... How much it cost, was it?
Yeah, that's how much the total cost of the scheme will be. Over the 20 years it runs. So that's for the period from 2010 until 2020.
It's worth it. I mean, you would know more than I and Ken. How was that policy developed, the RHI? How did that sort of come about?
So, and this is going back quite a long time now, to the 2008 Energy Act. So this Energy Act was primarily, it was something the government were pushing through to change the rules for support for renewable electricity. So that's what it was designed to do. And there was a campaign of lobbying led by the Renewable Energy Association, supported by Friends of the Earth and some other groups. And some academics got behind it as well, including my old boss. And that was focused on introducing a feed-in tariff. So in that legislation, it was supposed to be about big renewables. But actually, these people were lobbying quite hard for it to bring in a feed-in tariff for small renewables. And that ended up being the feed-in tariff that supported solar PV, which supported it quite expensively, but quite successfully, because we saw rapid rollout of PV. Somehow, and this is possibly on purpose, rather than having the word electricity, they had the word energy in that act. And that enabled the government to put a renewable heat incentive into the act. So it's partly by accident that they got into the regulations in the first place. The government was already talking about doing something, but this sped up the process. And so there was this renewable heat incentive put into regulations in 2009, and that basically gave the government the ability to set up the renewable heat incentive scheme. But you've got to think this was also going on at the same time that the EU's Renewable Energy Directive was coming in, and that Renewable Energy Directive required the UK to get 15% of its energy from renewables by 2020. So these sort of two things happened together. And the RHI eventually opened in 2010 for non-domestics, so big producers of renewable heat, and it opened in 2014 for domestic. So there are two big issues with it. One of them is that it's just underperformed, so it's not delivered anything like as much as it was expected to. Something like a fifth of the capacity it was expected to. But I think the more troubling element of it is that about 99% of the heat under the renewable heat incentive has gone to bioenergy. Majority of that is burning biomass. So this is biomass in small and large boilers. And some of the money has gone to biogas as well, which is gas that you make from breaking down waste, but also energy crops. And so, unfortunately, the RHI is not just underperformed. Where it has performed and deployed stuff, it's deployed unsustainable bioenergy sources. So it's really not a good news story. And it's a very expensive bad news story, unfortunately.
What are they going to do about it? Do you know?
We don't know. So it stops. So it's currently into two schemes. So the non-domestic side is sort of running, but not really doing anything because all the tariffs have been reduced, particularly for biomass, because the government said, oh, actually, that's not a great idea, supporting all of this biomass.
Domestic PV's obviously gone last year.
But the domestic RHI scheme is still running until applications until April next year, so April 2021. So now's a really good time to get a heat pump because you'll basically get all of the capital costs back for the system. For ground source, it's good as well, but for air source, you get about 10.5 pence per kilowatt hour.
So for a listener listening to this that's thinking about this technology, they can get the money back that costs to install?
Yes, but it's spread out over 7 years.
Okay.
So it's not particularly helpful because not many people have £5,000 lying around. And I ended up putting the heat pump on a credit card. So,
and obviously the other thing is they're going to need some competent engineers as well, aren't they?
Yeah. But beyond April 2021, there's currently no news about what's coming next. The government has just said we're thinking about it. So we don't know at the moment.
It's interesting stuff. Well, we're towards the end. We're going to have another episode with Richard because we've got so much more to discuss. So I'd like to thank my guests, one of my regular guest hosts, Ken Bone. Thank you, Ken.
Thank you very much.
And I'd definitely like to thank Richard. Thank you for your clever input into this, Richard. We really value it. I mean, like I say, engineers really value the fact that there's people in academia that are actually understanding us because we have got our own organisations that don't tend to either understand us or want to understand us, should I say. So thank you very much for coming along.
Thanks for coming down.
I'd like to thank my sponsor, MCS Cert, and you can find them at the mcscertified.com website. And we shall see you shortly with another episode with Richard. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Please subscribe to this podcast on your various podcast platforms, e.g. iTunes or Spotify. And if they give you the opportunity to rate these episodes and leave feedback, please do, as this will help others find them in search engines. If there are any topics you feel you would like discussed, please get hold of me at learn@betateach.co.uk or via my Twitter account at betateach. Once again, thank you to my sponsors, MCS, and you can find them at mcscertified.com.